First of all, you have to understand the outcome. If you want to count how many incidents of confrontations, military confrontations, how many battles have been waged between us and the Israelis, there are thousands, actually, in the southern part of Lebanon and in different parts. Now, let's go into this very incident when the Israelis are bombarding or they are targeting or they are not allowing the civilians to go back to their front. What did this tell you? They are in a dilemma. They are in a problem. The settlers that they have promised to bring them back by force, against Hezbollah will, they were not able to bring them. And there is now a division, a vertical division inside Israel.
But why are they not? They can. We are all going back to our villages. Why did not they not allow their settlers to go back?
Because they are tourists. They are not residents of the land.
They don't want to come back.
They are not the tourists of the land. They are not. They not come to the northern part of Palestine, to the settlements bordering Lebanon, without electricity or without one item missing, while our people are ready to go back and have a tent and live without electricity, without water, without anything, because we come from this land, from this soil, from this dirt. They don't come.
I witnessed that firsthand because we had some of our residents in Khiem who left the displacement center. They brought with them some candles because they knew there wouldn't be electricity. And we started laughing
Absolutely.
With them because we knew that the settlers would never live under such conditions.
This is one thing. This is the difference, the essential difference between us and them. And the other thing is that why they are doing it, because they are disappointed. The Lebanese came back, we were not allowed to come, or we cannot come, or we don't want to come. So they want to start to make these things, and I believe...
So this is not part of the ceasefire, because they're breaching the ceasefire.
The ceasefire will hold, this is my estimation.
But they're breaching it. They are breaching it.
They are violating.
And if you or the Lebanese authorities knew that the Israelis would be doing that, because I'm pretty sure that the Lebanese army knew that the Israeli entity was still stationed inside of Khiem, for example, why didn't they tell the people not to go there?
Well, actually, no. They issued the threats and they told them not to come. They don't want them to come because they don't want their settlers to
see. The Israelis. But why didn't the Lebanese authorities warn the people not to go to the front line?
They said that.
Now, after Zionist Israel fired at them.
Maybe they didn't know that the Israelis are going to do this. They didn't predict that the Israelis will do it. But I'll tell you, why should we be telling them? To tell you the truth, why should we be telling our people not to go to the villages? Why should we listen to the Israelis and help them in what they want? Of course, we want to save lives. This is for sure. But at the same time, we have to understand that we don't want to be responding to the Israelis of what they want. Again, I tell you, the Israelis are doing this because they are disappointed, because they feel the despair, because they feel that not one goal of what they have said were able to materialize in front of them. This is a moment of pride. This is a moment of glory for the Lebanese. And this is a moment of disappointment, of despair, and of humiliation to the Israelis and to all of their high-tech armaments.
As Hezbollah, as a political and a military part of this country, you designated Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri to take care of that, of the Lebanese side of the negotiations for the ceasefire. What are the Lebanese authorities saying at the moment in return to having their people not being able to enter their towns, and in retaliation to the breach of the ceasefire? Are they talking to Americans about this specific situation?
They are. I know of reports that the Lebanese authorities, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, President Najib Mikati is working on this. Actually, he called over many of the proper people in order to conduct, to raise the issue with them, so the Americans would pressure the Israelis to hold to the ceasefire. Are they going to listen? I believe the Israelis will only look for their own interests and what could bring them out of their dilemma that I talked about earlier. They have a problem with the settlers, they have divisions, political divisions. Some of them are not satisfied with the ceasefire from the very beginning, and they said this is an opportunity. But I can tell you, without the resistance, this glorious, steadfast, heroic, epic resistance, we wouldn't have reached this ceasefire. Listen from the mouth of the people.
September 17, the terrorist attack of the pagers. September 18, the terrorist attack of the walkie-talkies. September 20, the assassination of all of Rudwan forces leadership, first and second level. September 23 and 24, the waves that started the attack against South Lebanon, Biqa' and Beirut. September 27, and what it holds in our hearts. And all of these that are considered a big impact against the Lebanese resistance community. What can you tell us about the capabilities of Hezbollah? How have these capabilities been hit? I'm sorry, but this is a very emotional topic for me.
It has been said clearly from different parts of the world, from different backgrounds, not Hezbollah people, that what happened, if it happens to any government, to any organization, to any state, to any whatever, it would collapse directly. How could Hezbollah, and here I come to you to tell you, this is the miracle. This is the miracle that we have to believe in. This is the godly issue. This is the heavenly issue. This is the heavenly support. The people regrouped directly. They have filled all the vacancies in their organization, and they fought back against the Israelis. What did the Israelis think when they did what they did? You have just enumerated them. You have enlisted them in their hierarchical, in their chronological order, actually, starting by 17th, reaching to 27th, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, pager, whatever. Any organization, any state, any government would have collapsed. But if it's God, it's the party of God, it would never collapse because God is there. Mm-hmm. And this is the miracle, actually. They regrouped themselves and they fought back. The Israelis thought after what they did, they could come not only to Litani, they could come, if you want, to Awal, they could come to Sidon.
To Beirut?
They'd come to Beirut. Yes. And this is what they said. We want to change the face of the Middle East. Again, these dreams and these, if you want, nightmares that the dreams that have been turned into nightmares by the fighters of the resistance. This is what happened exactly. And I believe this is a lesson for all of us, that the believers, the true believers of Allah, the sons of Imam Khomeini, of Sayyid Khamenei, of Sayyid Nasrallah, they were there. The soul and the spirit of Sayyid Nasrallah was there. And it will always be there. And we will always be victorious. And we will always be...
What about the arsenal that was supposedly taken out? Israel says that it has taken out the arsenal of Hezbollah, especially in the southern part of the Litani. What is Hezbollah's strategy? Are we now going to stop seeing Hezbollah presence in the southern part of the Litani?
We have committed ourselves to the 1701. We are a resistance. We started as a resistance. We continue as a resistance. We are a political party at the same time. But I could tell you, as long as the Israeli threat is there, as long as the Israeli occupation is there, we have a duty and right to do. Had the Lebanese state done its role, you wouldn't have seen a resistance from the very beginning. So we are filling a gap. We are taking a vacant position in order to fill, to defend our people, and we'll always defend our people, whatever it takes.
I have so many questions, but we only have 5 minutes left, so I want to ask the most important question for the Lebanese people and all the lovers of the resistance around the world. There are rumors of a funeral procession for Secretary General Samahat Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the martyr, the legendary martyr of the resistance. Is such an event planned, and if so, when will it take place?
Well, actually, I know for a fact that yesterday there was a meeting in order conducting and deliberating over the issue, because we are going to talk about a cemetery, we are going to talk about a tomb for the Sayyid Nasrallah, but he is in our souls, not only in our hearts, not only in our feelings, not only in our minds. Now you are talking about a phenomenal leader, a legendary leader, who is there in the minds, hearts, feelings, and souls of people, spirits all over the world.
I have many friends who are waiting to in order to book a flight and come.
Absolutely, I know. Inshallah, hopefully, this is something that will be taken into consideration. I would leave this for the organizing committee, because I myself don't know, and this is not a shame not to know.
Sure.
They want to do something that would be worth it, something that would be good enough in order to match.
Will it be safe for the people to attend?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It will be safe. And let me tell you something. In the path of Sayyid Nasrallah, we are ready at any time, mm-hmm. for any moment, to sacrifice.
Well, there is also the question of the regional escalation that's happening. On the same day that the ceasefire was announced in Lebanon, we saw a regrouping of the terrorists in the northern part of Aleppo, and we saw them heavily attacking areas of the Syrian Arab Army. And now it's being said that Israel is obviously supporting these terrorists because they want to try and block the road against Hezbollah's military rearmament that comes from Syria. How true is that notion, and what is Hezbollah going to do about it?
I don't believe that this is the issue has to do with the rearmament or whatever. I would only tell you one simple thing, that the Israelis, after they have been dealt devastating blows by the heroic resistance fighters, they are trying to do anything to recompensate in any front, anywhere. So that's why they did this. Of course, this is going to help one way or another of exercising pressure over the Syrian presidency, the Syrian government, the Syrian state. But as they have failed here, they will fail there. And we will always, inshallah, with the souls, with the sacrifices, with the steadfastness of our people, they will always fail, we will always prevail, inshallah.
There's also a lot of political analysis talking about a possibility of opening the Golan Heights front with the Zionist entity. Will Hezbollah have a role in that if that is to happen?
This is something that I leave it for the military leadership and for the leadership of Hezbollah to decide about it. Let's say I said yes now or I said no. If I say no, then, they said no because they are weak, they cannot fight us back, they are busy minding their own affairs. Okay. Mm-hmm. And they would be appeased. Why should I make the Israeli feel calm from this thing? If I said yes, I commit myself to something that I have no role in. Mm-hmm. This is the decision of the leadership. And sometimes I always talk about the ambiguity. This is a constructive ambiguity. Sometimes to keep something for you is better than to divulge it or to talk it in front of the public. But we are always committed to the resistance cause, to fighting mm-hmm. the Israelis in any way possible we could.
One more minute, I want to ask about the reconstruction and the reimbursement for the people of the resistance in Lebanon with massive destruction that we saw in Beirut, Biqa'a, and South Lebanon. Who will lead this reconstruction effort and where will the necessary resources come from? This is a question that I've been asked so many times. We just have 1 minute, please.
Well, we know that Iran is one of the... you're talking about Iran because they have given a promise. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has given a promise. Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasim has given a promise. And I could tell you the plans are there and they are waiting for the moment to start. I could only promise people that as it has been built better and more beautiful, it's going to happen again, inshallah.
Inshallah. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, member of the Loyalty to the Resistance blog at the Lebanese Parliament. Always a pleasure. It was a proud moment for me to see your face again because I haven't had seen that for the past 70 days because you give us a lot of resilience with your presence and your ability to talk to our Western audience and tell them the real story, how it's happening in Lebanon. So, alhamdulillah for your safety and the safety of your family members and your community. Ladies and gents, thank you very much for being with us on board this very special episode with Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui. We always promise to give you the latest updates right here from West Asia on MediaStream. Assalamu alaikum.
Quran Quest on Iran Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Quran Quest on Iran Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speaker, Sayyid Salman Naghavi, a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. Well, we have been discussing some of the questions and answers related to this chapter. I mean, Surah Al-Fil, or chapter The Elephant. Before we move on with our questions, I think it's best for us to listen to the verses of this chapter, Surah Al-Fil, and then we'll come back and continue our program, Quran Quest, on Iran Radio. Stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
ألم تر كيف فعل ربك بأصحاب الفيل.
Have you not considered, O Muhammad, how your Lord dealt with the companions of the elephant?
ألم يجعل كيدهم في تضليل.
Did he not make their plan into misguidance?
وأرسل عليهم طيرا أبابيل.
And he sent against them birds in flocks.
ترميهم بحجارة من سجيل.
Striking them with stones of hard clay.
فجعلهم كعصف مأكول.
And he made them like eaten straw.
Welcome back to the program Quran Quest on Iran Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program. And my guest speaker, as always, Sayyid Salman Naqvi, a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University, helping me understand some of the questions of this chapter, Suratul Fil, or chapter The Elephant. It starts with the name of God, in the name of Allah, the All-Beneficent, the All-Merciful. Have you not regarded how your Lord dealt with the men of the elephant? Did he not make their stratagems go awry, send against them flocks of birds, pelting them with the stones of shale, thus making them like chewed up straw? Sayyid, I've asked you many questions regarding this chapter of the Quran. Let's talk about what lessons Muslims actually can derive from the events described in this chapter, Suratul Fil.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. One of the most important things that we need to understand that from this surah, that we as Muslims, we can learn this lesson, understand the importance of the Holy Kaaba, the house of Allah Almighty, and the great importance that it has in His eyes, that He is ready to protect it from all sorts of calamities, natural or otherwise man-made calamities, and he goes to great lengths to protect it and safeguard it. And even it shows that something which is has been there from times immemorial, it's not something new. The Holy Kaaba, the place which it was built by Abraham, Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, and his son Ismail, and the place was there even before that. And sometimes the stone that is there, Hajar Aswad, the black stone, that also has a special significance. Maybe it was an asteroid or something, but it's considered to be something heavenly also. So the whole structure of the Kaaba, in all its simplicity that it has as a cuboid, it's just a place of, you know, showing the unity of Allah Almighty, and showing the place where all Muslims have to bow down to. And their unity is comes from bowing down to one Allah and His place, which is as a symbol of His manifestation in this world in the form of a very simplistic thing made of stones. But it is so important that Allah Almighty wants to protect it in all manners possible. And even there's no need for human intervention for doing that.
So that is the. It's not even limited actually to one religion or two. It actually includes or encompasses all of the Abrahamic religion, right?
In the sense, yes, there's those people who believe in Holy Prophet Abraham. They should accept the importance of this place, whether they are Jews or Christians.
But before him, we didn't have that house, obviously, right?
The place was there, yes, there was something. He was rebuilding it or making it, you know. The place also has had a significance even before that, apparently. But yes, it was built by him in a way. So he is the father of all Abrahamic religions, so everyone should try to accept his significance. And it shouldn't just be specific for Muslims. Now, sometimes when one tries to recall the events of Prophet Moses and the Promised Land.
Yes.
And when he crosses the Red Sea from Egypt and comes to the Arabian Peninsula,
mm-hmm.
now he comes to the Sinai Desert maybe, comes to the Arabian Peninsula, he goes up to Palestine mm-hmm. and takes the place which is now Palestine, which yes. is the issue today we have this great calamity, mm-hmm. genocide taking place upon the Palestinian people by the Israelis, mm-hmm. the Zionists. So is it really the promised place, or has Prophet Moses taking them towards Kaaba? There's a slight possibility. There yes. is a possibility, there is a probability that the promised land may have been Kaaba itself, mm. Mecca itself.
I see.
Even when sometimes when you look at the Jews, when they are praying, they put a cuboid on their heads.
Yes.
With a strap. It's called Tanakh, I think. And it's cuboid. It resembles the Kaaba. It's mm-hmm. in the form of the Kaaba.
I see. Yes, I looked at it. Yeah, it looks very much like it, you know.
So sometimes we are prone to think and speculate that could it happen mean that the promised land was Mecca instead of the promised land, which is now considered to be in Palestine, mm-hmm. in Jerusalem.
Yes.
So that is a question that can come out in our minds. But as you said, as we mentioned in one of the previous sections, that the problem is that the Jews especially and the Christians, as well, when they take the Abrahamic tradition through Ishaq, Isaac.
Yes, Isaac, yeah.
They don't accept, they don't take it through Ismail.
Yes.
So therefore, we bifurcate the Muslims from the Christians and the Jews through this, you know, dichotomy which happens after the Prophet. Of course, the brothers they didn't have any
issues
with yes. Israel. But we have made...
The followers had a controversy.
So certainly, the importance of Kaaba should be there for all human beings and all Christians, especially Abrahamic religions. But again, as we see in the case of Abraham was apparently a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
He was apparently a Christian who wanted to dominate Kaaba. He wanted to destroy Kaaba because, as we mentioned, he had set up a similar worshipping place in Yemen. He was not from Yemen. He had come from Rome, from the Roman Empire, maybe, which had sent him along with his other people to crush people in the Yemeni region.
So was he from Rome?
He had come from Najashi, from Najashi, the Roman Empire. Had asked Najashi to send an army to Yemen to take care of a person who had, you know, who had attacked the Christians or attacked the people there.
The king of Ethiopia, you mean? That
yes,
time?
Yes, Najashi.
All right.
So he had come. Abraham had come with an army from Ethiopia to Yemen, and then they had established the Christian faith in Yemen, and Abraham then revolted against his commander and uh-huh. took over Yemen.
I see. A sort of coup d'etat.
Yes. Then when Najashi found out about that, he, you know, was angry. And then Abraham sent some gifts to him and sent him the earth, the soil from Yemen to show that I accept your rulership. And he was kept in place by Najashi there.
Mm-hmm,
is another one of the narrations that we have.
I see.
And then he wanted to build something there as an alternative to the Kaaba, and he mm-hmm. wanted to invite the Arabs of the Arabian Peninsula to that worship place, and wanted them to leave the Kaaba.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And they didn't accept that, so he came in to destroy them. So is showing that the Abrahamic faith through Ismail is coming down, and the Kaaba is the center of that. And Allah Almighty wants to say that this is the true place which has to be worshipped.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Quran Quest, on Iran Radio. Don't go away.
In sa'altum an ilahi فهو رحمن رحيم أنزل الشارع حنيفا رحمة للعالمين رحمة للعالمين.
You are listening to Quran Quest on Iran Radio. It's a program that attempts to answer your Quranic questions.
If you ask me who my God is, on whose name I call, if you ask me who my God is, He's the God of us all, Allah the Merciful. If you ask me what my book is that I hold in my hand, if you ask me what my book is, it's the Holy Quran, the Holy Quran.
Back to the program Quran Quest on Iran Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sayyid Salman Naghavi, my guest speaker in the room or studio with me, answering my Quranic questions regarding this important chapter of the Quran, Surah Al-Fil, or chapter The Elephant. Before the break, you said something about the Abraha having this coup d'etat, basically, coming from Ethiopia or the Najashi's army, but he separated or renegated from, you know, his rule of law, basically. And correct me if I'm wrong, this is my impression from your words before the break, that you said that he wanted all of the Muslims or those people actually who were worshipping Kaaba or God, because they were coming from the Abrahamic religion, all of them, and he wanted them to worship another place in Yemen, as you said, right?
He had because built a very great church-like thing, I mean, a place like Kaaba, to bring people over towards Christianity.
So,
of course, the Arabs were not they were not Muslims.
Yes,
they were not. But some of them, yes, they were upright Muslims. Dina Hanif.
Exactly. That's what I meant. But because the Holy Prophet was not there actually to come out with Islam or the Quran, and so was that the reason that Abraha had issues with Kaaba, so that he wanted to destroy it? Was that the reason?
Yes, that was the reason.
Exactly.
In one of the beginning sessions, we also mentioned that he wanted to bring, made and established a place of worship in Yemen as a place for the center of Christianity, and he wanted all Arabs to come towards that. Mm-hmm. When they didn't accept that, they had remained steadfast on the Kaaba. Now, whether it was due to belief or due to custom and tradition,
mm-hmm.
they were proud of it, so they did not accept that. And therefore, he wanted to come and just destroy the Kaaba, so it is wiped out, and people turn to his place of worship.
I see. Thank you very much, Sayyid. That was Sayyid Salman Naghavi, my guest speaker, a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University, talking with me in the studio, answering my Quranic questions regarding Surah Al-Fil or chapter The Elephant, and all of my questions regarding the Quran, my appreciations to him. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program, Quran Quest, on Iran Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Quran Quest, the program that answers your Quranic questions.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. From wherever you're listening to us, welcome to a new episode of Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma once more. I have the honor to be at your service as the host, and I have two very dear guests with me, Brother Liaghat and Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum and welcome.
Thank you so much. Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for coming here. Well, I already know you, and I guess a lot of our listeners know you as well. But then, just as the ritual of this program goes, I would like you to introduce yourself pretty much briefly. Tell us who you are and what's your background.
This is Zainab Askari, and I have studied master's in linguistics, and then I studied Hausa for past 10 years. Took me a lot of time to study Hausa, and also researching in the field of women issues.
So that's very great. And you, Brother Liaghat?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm Muhammad Liaghat Abbas from India, and right now I'm doing my master's in psychology. And of course, with Hausawi background as well, doing my Hausa studies at the same time. And of course, my specialization is in psychology, Islamic psychology, mm-hmm. and history.
That's great. Thank you. So thank you both of you for being here. I guess like this, we can have a pretty interesting discussion today. Well, living as a human being is very difficult. Like I was reading this somewhere, and it became so important for me to know, really, what's the meaning of success? Like the woman in there, the woman who actually composed that poetry, the gist of her words was that at the end of the day, we're not going to be judged by how much money we have gained, by how much book we have written, by how much houses we have built, by whatever materialistic thing that we have gained, gathered, flourished, accomplished, or whatever. We're not going to be judged by these stuff. At the end of the day, it's the heart that's going to count. At the end of the day, your passion, your kindness toward human beings would count more and more. And then it raised this question in my mind that, okay, really, how do we define success?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. For us, success is just amassing degrees and looking for better career options.
Yeah,
and
getting into PhD. First of all, BA, then MA, then PhD.
Then PhD, like half of our life, more than half of our life. More than half of our life goes in
until you get retired.
Yeah. So then we are like all in this journey. And it's not like, see, for example, I think age-wise, it differs. For like example, when I'm in my school days, success seems something to me. Like, for example,
achieving
a college degree.
Yeah.
But when I have achieved that college
degree...
But
when I'm in college, I don't think
now
that
my success has changed.
Yeah.
Now having PhD in my hand is what matters to me. Then when I have that, then I am looking for a good career option. Then when I have that, I'm looking to make a good house. When I also have that, I still am not satisfied.
Yeah. And there's no end to human greed in the sense of whatever they dream for.
But it's like I count this as success, but this is not the real success.
Mm-hmm.
For me, real success is when you have found the purpose of your life.
I would say success is different for different people, just like sister has said. And in every single part of our life, the spectrum of life, we have
as much as individuals we have in this world,
exactly.
We have definition of success.
Definitions of success change from person to person. Example, for few people, it's money. For few, it is a degree. That's it. For few, it's like helping others.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's the definition completely changes. And
it could
of course,
be anything.
It can be, yeah. And also, I would say religion also plays a very big role over here when we speak about success. And for people who are atheists, example.
Exactly.
Success is different. But for a Hindu, the definition of success might be different. But for a Muslim who is from a different sect, like example, he's a Sunni. success might be different. But for me, as a Shia example, success is completely different.
Yeah, but that's, now you just popped it up very interestingly. For an atheist, what would be called success? Like, there's no meaning, everything is going to end at a point, and then nothing after that.
Exactly.
What is success?
Success, atheists again differ, okay? Atheists, they are atheists who don't believe in the hereafter, who don't believe in life after death, example.
Yeah.
And who are characterless, okay? For those people, success means to gain everything which is materialism. Whatever is materialistic.
Yeah, luxury, money, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. All the luxuries, all the pleasures of the world, be it halal or haram, from our perspective, they want it, okay? But for those atheists who are, like I would say, decent, have character, for them, of course, they kind of follow laws, they abide by the laws, they go with the morals, example, okay?
Yeah, morals.
But me, as a Shia example, I would definitely go after the hadith of Rasulullah, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, where he says, Ya Ali, you and your Shias are successful on the Day of Judgment, example. Of course, if we have the wilaya, that is the main success, okay? Mm-hmm. And of course, Shia, when we speak about Shia, we have to define what is a Shia. Who is a follower? Who is a true follower, example?
Yeah, who's a true follower? Exactly. That's a matter of question.
That is the actual success, according to Rasulullah, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Me as a Shia, I have to see what the Rasul, my prophet, is saying. Example, he brought Amirul Mu'minin into picture. And of course, when Imam comes into picture, there are the 12 infallibles with him, indeed. And following them is definitely obligatory. And through their following to, like, their path, okay, following them is the real success in this world and the hereafter, indeed. If I'm following them in this world, I'm successful in this world. Actually, this is the beginning of the hereafter, isn't it?
Exactly.
So I'm successful on the Day of Judgment. Likewise, I'm successful in this world.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
They say life is nothing but dream within dream. And I do believe that, yes, it is true. Human beings, in order to continue their life, in order to come from one day to another day, in order to pass these days and minutes and seconds, they have to have dreams. They have to build some wishes for themselves, some purposes. They have to establish different purposes at different phases of their life because they want to continue. Because who knows where the road is going? Maybe it's going to be a journey of only 1 year, 5 years, 10 years. Who knows? And some people would go up until even 100. They would live up to a century. But then what they really need for this life is a fuel. And that fuel is their wishes, their dreams, and whatever they define as success in their lives. So if I would be a kind of a person who dreams of a better life, who dreams for success as in materialistic things, would you call it a trivial sort of purpose?
Not necessarily. So,
you know what I want to get? What gives my purpose value and worth? What is going to make the way I define success in my life so valuable?
When I don't see just myself, then it's going to give a huge meaning to my success. For example, if I think working in a particular company is success to me, if it's just for me, then it's really, you're going to end up in some dead end.
Mm-hmm.
But if I intend to work somewhere to help out my family, to feed the hungry, to, I don't know, carry out the so many religious
To forget
deeds,
about the ego.
To forget about myself, to forget about ego, not completely myself, then it's aligned with the purpose of life. Because purpose of life was not just to, it's not just to stay on the, you know, on the prayer mat, right? Like we had a person who was always on the prayer mat, and Prophet said he's not entering the paradise because he felt like he has wrongly understood the concept of ibadat, worship. And Allah also says, oh, we did not create man and jinn except for ibadat. So ibadat could be everything.
Whatever your interaction with other people, how much help you're going to offer.
For example, I said, I intend to take this degree because with this degree, I want to educate others. I want to spread the ilm, right?
Yeah.
And like, it was very interesting for me, like Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, He said that there are some sins that even are not even erased when you even pray for forgiveness. Then a question was asked, then what does erase such sins? How are these sins erased? And he says, hard working to earn more. See, so like in religion of Islam, we should, when we say, okay, real success is to promote spiritual growth within you, it never means you have to leave the worldly life aside.
Yeah. Like you the models we have, you have had in our Islamic heritage, none of our imams were sitting at home doing nothing.
Doing nothing, right?
Only so, worshipping. None of them were like that.
So there was always a balance. There was always a balance. And there should be this balance. Like, it's not even like, I don't know, well, it's not reported much, but it's like Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was once wearing something very beautiful, and a man approaches him and he tells him, I never saw Prophet wearing such clothes. He says, that time the condition of Muslims was not really good, but in this time every Muslim can afford such dressing. So it's okay. Adornment is liked in Islam. So when we say something about growth and success, it never means that you have to abandon the worldly life.
Exactly. Yeah, this is very important. Yeah, this is a very important point that we have to take into consideration, and that's why I asked this question. When we say success in the religious respect, we do not mean that you have to forget about your life, even the materialistic life. Like, we had so much of recommendations about you have to gain prosperity for you, yourself, and your family. So I asked the same question. What makes my purpose valuable?
Just like sister had stated about the ayah, actually I had the same ayah in my mind, like وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسِ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ. When a person like is created for a purpose, actually serving the purpose,
and
is
literally,
the actual success.
It would be very much more better if you give us the translation of that verse.
Okay, sorry. So we did not create the jinn and humans except that they worship me.
And this worship has so much of definition.
Exactly, definitely. So, you know, when we plant an apple tree, okay, the purpose of an apple tree is to give apples, isn't it? When we see apples upon the tree, we say, oh, this is a successful tree.
Mission accomplished.
Tree. Exactly. This tree is a successful tree.
Yeah.
This has served its purpose. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Effect.
Likewise, a pen. Okay, when it's writing properly and it's like it wrote properly for us and it didn't get spoiled, it served its purpose. So the creation of the pen is successful in this arena. Likewise, as we human beings, as she as example, to be more precise now, if we serve our purpose, then we are successful once. Now, what is serving the purpose goes on a very large scale. Example, worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, just like the sister has stated. Example, if we are living a materialistic life to be like to what we see is apparent, but all our intentions are based on the beliefs, then we are serving the purpose. That is when we are successful.
Yeah.
We see people who live materialistic life, they help other people. But the intention is not in line or it's not connected to the beliefs.
Yeah.
The belief system...
Intentions have a great role.
Exactly. Those are the ones which serve the purpose. Example, helping the needy. I am helping the needy. Okay. There's another person who is helping the needy. Okay. But I might serve the purpose of my creation. Okay. Maybe I'm worshipping and that person is not worshipping.
Yeah.
You see, the purpose changes. So, over here, me, because I have intentions behind, I'm a successful... I'm just giving you an example. I'm not talking about myself.
Yeah.
I'm just speaking on
to
a general basis.
To make it more
basis.
Relatable.
Exactly. So, now I am a successful person. Why? Because there is intention in line with my beliefs. And that person, example, he might do good deeds. Okay, he might do things which are, in apparent way, found to be good. Okay, but at the same time, he might not serve the purpose of his creation. You see what I mean?
Because of the intention.
Exactly. So yeah. Intentions are what make us a successful person or an unsuccessful one. Okay,
exactly.
According to me. Okay,
yeah.
And this is a very deep discussion, of course, which I don't know if I can wind it up very quickly. But this has a very deep root with wilaya, with guardianship, with leadership.
For sure, yeah.
Okay? Like example, And again, controversial discussions come in place, which I don't want to enter it into. Okay, wherever there is leadership, wherever there's wilaya, those deeds are accepted. If we see the context of many ahadith, okay? So over here, me helping, me living a materialistic life even, is not a bad thing. Until unless I have a deep root with, example, with the imams, with the Ahlul Bayt, with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, with the hereafter.
And your intentions being in line with whatever with God them. Has planned for you.
Exactly.
Thank you for your listening and your attention. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Rabbal Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, Lati Umar, rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
Since Israel's genocide in Gaza began last year, defenders of Palestinian human rights have experienced levels of repression not seen since the era of McCarthyism. In Canada, one of the most notorious cases in the past year was that of Dr. Yipeng Ji. In November of last year, Dr. Ji was suspended from the University of Ottawa. At the time of his suspension, Dr. Ji had been a fourth-year public health and preventive medicine resident and was completing a residency at the Public Health Agency of Canada. The suspension appears to have been precipitated by Dr. Yoni Friedhoff, an associate professor of family medicine at the University of Ottawa. On his Substack page, Friedhoff drew attention to a number of Dr. G's social media posts about Palestine, which Friedhoff falsely characterized as anti-Semitic. They included a post saying, quote, "Ottawa standing with Gaza," close quote, and featuring a photo of a sign stating, quote, "From the rivers to the sea, Palestine will be free," close quote. Friedhoff called that particular chant genocidal because, according to him, it implies the elimination of the State of Israel. An online petition calling for Dr. G's reinstatement garnered more than 100,000 signatures. It expresses solidarity with Dr. G for advocating for the human rights of Palestinians and called for the university to reverse the suspension. It also called for an apology and a thorough investigation of the decision to suspend him. Dr. G was subsequently reinstated by the University of Ottawa, but he refused to return there. He then traveled to Gaza with a team of Canadian doctors and spent several weeks in Gaza treating Palestinians in need of medical treatment. Now here to discuss all of these events with me is Dr. G himself. Thank you so much for joining me, Dr. G.
Thank you so much for having me, Dimitri.
I want to move on to the question of accountability for the person who weaponized allegations of anti-Semitism against you, namely Dr. Yoni Friedhoff. Because, as I mentioned at the outset, the University of Ottawa reinstated you, I think we can quite safely infer that the decision makers there came to the conclusion that Friedhoff's allegations were false. It seems to me, as a lawyer, that when somebody, particularly a medical professional, makes such a grave allegation falsely against a fellow member of the profession, there should be consequences. Do you agree with that? And if so, are you aware whether there's been any accountability whatsoever for Friedhoff, even a reprimand from his colleagues in the medical profession?
Not that I'm aware of. I've had conversations with senior leadership at the University of Ottawa's Faculty of Medicine that were responsible for handling my internal complaint that I shared right away when this other doctor affiliated with the faculty and with the university publicly doxed me and said, you know, libelous, defamatory, and hateful remarks about me in a public forum. And so I took it internally into this kind of bullying and harassment kind of complaint process. And internally, I was told that the only kind of accountability that they really asked of him was to stop posting about me moving forward, which he hasn't done. There was, you know, a question of I asked the question to, you know, the faculty affairs vice dean who was responsible for managing my complaint against him, that shouldn't you ask him to take these hateful comments and remarks down, especially, you know, after the committee had even investigated and whatnot, the professionalism kind of within the institution, they had investigated me and found nothing to maintain those accusations that the university actually took seriously. They said, oh, okay, it didn't even cross our mind to ask him to take those posts down. And when they did ask him, they came back to me and said, you know, why did you put me in this position? Why did you, like, why did I ask you to do your job to hold this, professor within the institution who has power and privilege over learners? Why did I ask you to do your job to hold someone accountable? And so the ways in which I'm seeing like senior leadership within the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Ottawa not have any backbone whatsoever to stand up to these kinds of bad faith actors, to these kinds of colleagues who are weaponizing anti-Semitism. And I think I do want to make a note that if we want to talk about anti-Semitism, I think we need to be able to situate it within understanding how far-right white supremacist movements are very much pushing anti-Semitic tropes and stereotypes and racism. But when we focus on Israel, when we focus on any criticism of Israel as anti-Semitism, it actually completely makes everyone not safe, especially Jewish people in the diaspora. I have many Jewish friends and colleagues and comrades within this Palestine organizing, you know, space that continued to teach me so much about situating anti-Semitism within the broader context of structural oppression, that oppression in any form is a threat and danger to all of us. And to kind of section it out and to also focus almost entirely the energy on dissuading or silencing any criticism of Israel is you know, something that we should all be absolutely concerned about, and is a freedom of expression issue amongst many other issues, including the protection of anyone to defend human rights anywhere in this world. And we're seeing that play out with, you know, blatant anti-Palestinian racism and rhetoric and actions here on occupied Turtle Island.
So you talked a moment ago about the inadequacy of the University of Ottawa's response. On the 15th of January, the School of Epidemiology and Public Health announced with some fanfare that you had been reinstated. What they said was they were thrilled to welcome you back, and they referred to you as an outstanding learner and colleague. But ultimately, you didn't return. Why is that?
So I had meetings with closed door meetings, some one-on-one meetings with the people that made the decision to ultimately suspend me. These were people very high up within the administration, which included the Dean of Medicine at the Faculty of Medicine, the senior vice deans, that, you know, felt the need to hold an emergency meeting on a Saturday to look at my social media posts after it was sent in by that community member, that that other family doctor who's affiliated with the faculty. And so I met with them individually to find a path forward, right? If you're going to take these accusations of anti-Semitism, of social media posts that stood for Palestinian human rights, if you're going to take those accusations seriously and investigate, and then the investigating committee actually disagreed completely with those accusations, recommended immediate reinstatement without any disciplinary action, actually went as far as to recommend an apology from the university to me, which has never been, still has not been delivered. And then to have those conversations with those senior officials who made that immediate decision way back in November of last year, to find a path forward. And what I really wanted was an acknowledgement of anti-Palestinian racism within this institution, because I also saw other cases. I sat on faculty council. This is the highest governing committee for the Faculty of Medicine as a resident representative. And I saw cases of multiple medical students and their social media posts. And I was like, do you not see this McCarthyist witch hunt happening? Really with the framing of rooted in anti-Palestinian racism. And to see, you know, blatant anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, anti-Palestinian hate and rhetoric shared within those spaces, this like a committee of 50 of the leading, you know, academic educators, administrators within the Ottawa region for like future physicians is just so appalling that, you know, I felt like the dean, the senior vice dean, they very much needed to have some kind of process to protect learners from anti-Palestinian racism that is so systemic and ingrained and being perpetuated and upheld by this institution, by an academic institution that's supposed to educate medical learners like future doctors. And so that was one piece. And certainly the other piece was an apology to me. And neither of these things could be fulfilled.
As you may know, Dr. G, on October 10th of this year, about a month ago, a UN commission of inquiry found that Israel had committed war crimes and crimes against humanity, including the crime against humanity of extermination mm-hmm. in Gaza by attacking health facilities and also through its grotesque abuses of detainees and hostages. And I'm quoting from the October 10th press release of the Independent Commission of Inquiry. Israel has perpetrated a concerted policy to destroy Gaza's healthcare system as part of a broader assault on Gaza, committing war crimes and the crime against humanity of extermination with relentless and deliberate attacks on medical personnel and facilities. And of course, prior to this conclusion having been reached, we saw abundant evidence that Israel was doing just that, that it was attacking in a systematic way the healthcare system of Gaza. And in light of this evidence, I just, it boggles the mind that any member of the legal profession in this country would not only remain silent in the face of what is being done to the healthcare system of Gaza, but actually in a way facilitate it by vilifying any member of the medical profession who speaks out against these crimes. You, in fact, not only did not return to the University of Ottawa, you also resigned from the board of directors of the Canadian Medical Association. What was the background of that particular decision?
Yeah, I mean, it all happened really clustered and overlapping in its timelines, because when that physician who publicly doxed me in early November, he also sent those social media posts to the Canadian Medical Association, for which I was the sole resident physician board member of back then and in fall of last year. And so I received a text from someone within the Canadian Medical Association. They said it was really urgent matter. And for, you know, to give them benefit of the doubt at the time, I really thought it was them reaching out to provide support. To say, hey, there's a bad faith actor here that's saying really awful things about you. How can we support you? It turns out I had that meeting with, you know, the CEO of the Canadian Medical Association, their the vice chair and their legal counsel. So it was like a one, it was like just me and three of them. Maybe it was four, I forget exactly. Essentially, they framed it as, no, you need to apologize. You need to apologize publicly to everyone, and then to also provide one-on-one apologies to certain people within the board, certain people who hold influence on the institution, who do not even hold like positions within the institution, but have large sway because they are like a past president. And so I continuously thought over this, and then later it actually ended up becoming a legal mediation process. And through that entire process, there were just certain kinds of concessions that just absolutely did not make any sense for me to make such concessions to stay on as a board member.
So let's turn then to what you did do, how you decided to devote your efforts amongst other activities, I'm sure, and that is you went to Gaza. Could you just start by giving us an overview of what you did?
I entered Gaza in mid-February of this year. And the journey began really in Cairo. We started in Cairo with United Nations convoy, and